Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. A momentous day on Capitol Hill, where House Democrats are on the verge of passing a nearly $2 trillion coronavirus relief bill, one of the most significant of its kind, in part because of its size, also because it hasn't gotten any Republican support. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us now from the Capitol building. Claudia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we're now a year into this pandemic. It is the third major relief bill Congress has taken up. Here's Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, a Democrat from Texas, earlier today.
The people of the United States won with a Democratic government that has come to the rescue with the American Rescue Plan. The long lines will stop with $20 billion for vaccines. Cash-strapped Americans will get $1,400 and extended unemployment.
How would you put the significance of this day into context?
Yes, it is very historic. Democrats have been fighting to approve this level of aid to the economy since last year when Republicans controlled the Senate and thwarted those attempts multiple times. It's one of the largest bills passed in the past year to address the pandemic, and it's immensely popular among Americans. It includes a long wish list for Democrats, from funding for state and local governments who have faced dire financial concerns since late last year, especially in those late final months of 2020. They need to address shortfalls for their frontline workers. It also includes funding for vaccines. It also has direct payments for Americans, more funding for schools, and efforts to get workers back to work. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi herself called it a remarkable, historic, transformative piece of legislation. It also includes new financial support for parents. This comes in the form of a new child tax credit that many Democrats say will help lift families out of poverty. They'll be looking at a new child tax credit of about $3,000 for children 6 to 17, $3,600 for children under the age of 6. The amount is gradually reduced for couples that earn over $150,000 a year or individuals earning $75,000 a year. Families eligible for this full credit would start getting direct payments for this credit starting in July of about $300 per child, and this would go through the end of the year on a monthly basis. But all in all, lawmakers will have approved about $6 trillion in funding to address the pandemic, and it's going to take some time to spend that level of funding.
Well, everything you just laid out there, Republicans say it goes too far. Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
It just throws out money without accountability. But remember what Margaret Thatcher said, Mr. Speaker. Socialism, you'll eventually run out of other people's money. You've been doing a very good job of it so far.
What else have you heard from Republicans today?
Yes, Kevin McCarthy was largely backing up other members of his party who were raising these type of concerns on the House floor today. For example, Jason Smith of Missouri raising fears that this legislation could impact Medicare. It could result in automatic cuts to Medicare. However, Democrats have argued it won't come to that, that they'll be able to head off these kind of cuts that would be triggered by this level of spending before it could possibly happen. McCarthy also complained that a lot of this money won't be spent for some time for schools. For example, they are still spending money. Schools are still spending money from previous stimulus bills approved last year. But largely, McCarthy and others have made this overarching argument that this money won't come for free, that Americans will have to pay all of this back for generations to come. And they continue to note this isn't bipartisan. And as a reminder, Democrats used a workaround known as reconciliation to pass this with just Democratic support.
Yeah, it is not bipartisan to say the least, but it is President Biden's first legislative victory, and we'll watch to see what implications that might have for his agenda going forward. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you so much.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
People in Texas are now able to walk around in public without a face mask to help curb the spread of COVID-19. Businesses are also able to open at 100% capacity. Governor Greg Abbott says in light of the recent dip in COVID-19 cases, he sees no reason the state can't get back to normal. Well, for more on the implications of this decision there in Texas, we have with us Dr. Jewel Mullen. She's a public health expert and epidemiologist at Dell Medical School at the University of Texas in Austin. Dr. Mullen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So some stores like Kroger are still going to require masks, but others won't. How concerned are you about the spread of the virus without this mask mandate and with businesses at full capacity?
I share the concern that releasing people from the mandates now is actually going to slow down progress and maybe even set us backwards in the response to the pandemic.
Can we talk a little bit about what's happening across the state? Cases are down since the winter surge, but in Houston specifically, deaths still average around 200 a day.
Yes. We hear the story of Houston, where we've also learned that all of the known COVID variants are being found, which once again means we worry about ongoing spread. That's the kind of warning sign that has officials there concerned and that we should be paying attention to across the state.
Yes, what you're talking about there is these variants that have been found in Houston, the first one found in the UK, South Africa, and Brazil. Those have shown to infect people more easily. How much could the spread of those actually complicate this recovery?
One of the things that we've been trying to help people understand is that the fewer precautions they take, the greater the risk there is for those variants to emerge and spread further. So could we be seeing the beginning of the next snowball forming? That would be one thing that I would worry about. And there's no such thing as a fixed border, even inside of a state, which means that we would not expect that issue to remain just in Houston. I would like to add that Texas remains near the bottom ranking among states that have vaccinated their population. Fewer than 1 in 10 Texans have been fully vaccinated for COVID thus far. So we have one of the most populous states in the U.S. with one of the least vaccinated populations compared to other states.
But Governor Abbott is actually pointing to, though, the vaccine rollout as one of the reasons for lifting the mandate. I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that doesn't justify this latest order.
So as a public health official, I always want to be able to tell people where there's optimism. That the vaccines are rolling out is something to be optimistic about. That they are not rolling out as efficiently, effectively, and equitably as they ought to is a reason for us to be more motivated to do better and to keep our guard up at the same time.
Do you think, though, what Governor Abbott is saying, I mean, essentially that the rollout is happening, we're going to see a ramp up, that could offset what we're seeing in terms of numbers and the potential for increase with this lifting of the mask mandate?
In the context of our saying herd immunity, where we can really feel confident about protection of the population being maybe 70 or 80%, but nobody can say the exact percentage, says there's a long road to travel from where we are now to where we need to be, even with vaccinations. A lot of Texas is rural, and I remain concerned about what we're not hearing about communities there, some of whom have not seen any vaccine yet. And we're also talking about a state where many people are still reeling in the aftermath of the power and water outages.
That's right, because Texas is still recovering from those water outages and flooding. Before we let you go, I want to ask you about the implications of mixed messaging around the virus and your personal thoughts about all of this. Here's Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo on MSNBC last week after the governor's announcement.
Forget what the governor says. Forget what the law says. What does our own humanity call upon us to do? And that's to be cognizant that this is one of the best things we can do is wear masks.
I mean, the chief is a high-ranking official giving a very different plea than the governor. With all of the experience you have in this crisis and the data available, what's your takeaway message for those who live in Texas who are now hearing all of these messages, who understand that there's no mask mandate, and really just want some direction moving forward?
I would encourage people to think less about the sound bites and oppositional language. We can fight forever. And in some places, we probably will, because not everybody's always going to agree. But if we could organize around a shared desire to truly get to the other side of this together, we could share some strategies that everybody ought to buy into and leave the politics on the margin.
That was Dr. Joel Mullen, a public health expert and epidemiologist at Dell Medical School at the University of Texas in Austin, on Texas lifting its mask mandate today. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Stark political divides were on display in the U.S. House of Representatives today as lawmakers debated President Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package. Democratic House Budget Committee Chair John Yarmuth called it one of the most consequential pieces of legislation in modern history.
It will cut the child poverty rate in half. In half. Just think about what that will mean for those children and their futures and the future of our country.
In response, Congressman Jason Smith of Missouri urged fellow Republicans to vote no.
Rewards the political class, not the working class. That should be the name of this bailout plan.
President Biden is expected to sign this bill into law, and tomorrow night he'll give his first primetime address, marking the day 1 year ago that the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus outbreak a pandemic. Our political strategist joins us now. Matt Mikowiak is a Republican. Welcome.
Hey there.
And Jamal Simmons, a Democrat. Jamal, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jamal, this is President Biden's 50th day in office now, and he's on track to sign his first major legislative accomplishment. How are Democrats feeling today?
I think Democrats feel the way Joe Biden felt when the health care bill got passed. It was a big expletive-deleting deal, right? people are very happy. As you heard in the package, child poverty is going to be down by half. There's $31 billion in there for Native American communities and $39 billion for child care infrastructure. You know, the list goes on of things, not just the $1,400 payment. For families, the Democrats are going to make sure there's a lot of things that are retrofitted for the current economy that we have, at least for the foreseeable future, the next couple of years. So, of course, everybody wants to focus on what was missing. There are lots of people in the media who want to focus on what's missing from the package, but there's a lot that's there for people to be pleased about and families to do better with.
Well, and yet, Matt, no Republicans are on board. Why not? Polls show that this bill is pretty popular with a wide swath of America.
Well, I don't think very many Americans know what's in the bill. I think the fact that it's being called a COVID relief bill, you know, probably makes people want to be for it. The reason no Republicans voted for it is no Republican was involved in drafting it. And after you look at what happened in the last months of the Trump administration, we had three or four different COVID relief efforts that were passed on a massive bipartisan basis, CARES Act 1, CARES Act 2, the PPP program. It's a shame that Biden and Pelosi and Schumer decided to go in the direction of a partisan bill that's $1.9 trillion, add significantly the national debt. And by one analysis I saw, only spends 1% of the money actually on COVID relief, bails out blue cities, blue states, unions, provides $1,400 stimulus payments to people in prison, to immigrants who are in the country illegally. The list goes on and on. I don't doubt that there are some good things in the bill. It'd be pretty hard to spend almost $2 trillion and not do some good things. But I think for Republicans, they feel like they should have been consulted. They should have had an opportunity to offer direct feedback. And for that, I think you would have had some Republican votes. So this reminds me a little bit of the stimulus bill that Obama passed in his first year. They made that a partisan exercise as well. When you do that, you do not have the other party invested. And so now the Democrats either have to make sure that this thing works, and if it does, they'll benefit from it. But if it doesn't work, they're going to pay the price. And if you remember, in 2010, Republicans won 63 seats in Congress, the most in history. And I think there's a chance that kind of wave could be coming.
Jamal, I do want to give you a chance to weigh in here.
Just a little bit. Yeah, I would slow Matt's roll just a little bit here in this way.
Go for it.
The very first meeting that President Biden had in the White House with legislators was with a group of Republican senators who came to the Oval Office to have a conversation about the bill. The problem is those Republican senators didn't put anything on the table that they were willing to sort of negotiate over and to raise. They couldn't get a bipartisan agreement out of that group. So what Democrats have done, I think this is what Republicans are not used to. They're not used to Democrats saying, look, here's where we're going. Get on board the bus. Look, we'll tinker with the paint job and figure out how to get new tires. But this is the bus. Get on board or get rolled over by it. And so now Republicans know that Democrats are going to get what they want done. I think the next time they may be more willing to sit down and do a deal because they don't want to get steamrolled by the Biden juggernaut.
Well, right. Matt, the question to me is, like, what's the Republican strategy here now? Do they feel wounded to the point that they're not going to be willing to compromise on other issues like infrastructure? Is that now out of the picture?
Yeah, I don't know, because, you know, the Republican approach on infrastructure and the Democratic approach are going to be very different. On the Republican side, you know, if you were using public dollars to leverage private dollars through public-private partnerships, I think that's something that they could probably agree on. If it's spending massive amounts of money and adding more debt to the national debt and, you know, giving away to unions and addressing things like Davis-Bacon and prevailing wage, that's going to be a non-starter, I imagine. And I think that's probably the direction that the Biden team would want to go. Look, Biden's instinct is to be bipartisan. It's what his record has been in Congress over all the 30 or 35 years he was there. That's why I'm so surprised they decided to go the partisan route, that they really didn't offer much in the way of consultation. They decided it was going to be a big bill. Republicans said they couldn't stomach a $2 trillion bill. And they decided they had to have the $15 minimum wage in there, which I think it was the U.S. Chamber or some outside group said was going to cost us 1.2 to 1.3 million jobs within the first year. So, look, I congratulate the Democrats. They did hold their votes. They got the 50 votes plus the vice president in the Senate. They hold their coalition together. But now the American public is going to render a judgment on whether this bill succeeds or not. Rhetoric doesn't matter anymore. It's either going to work or it's not, and they're going to either benefit or not from it.
I think you are right that we are going to have an opportunity to see what the repercussions of having a partisan bill is. We'll find out. But I want to move on because I think it's worth noting, too, how much has happened in the past year. On March 11th, 2020, a year from tomorrow, Donald Trump was the president, and he addressed the nation from the White House. Let's listen.
The virus will not have a chance against us. No nation is more prepared or more resilient than the United States.
We now have a new president. Democrats are in control of the Senate. The virus is still killing a lot of Americans. Jamal, reflect on this past year. What did we learn in American politics?
Well, we first of all learned the American people are incredibly resilient, and they're willing to shoulder a burden that people were worried, you know, that America had gotten soft over the last 60 years since World War II. But I think we've seen that Americans can shoulder a burden. I think that what we've also seen is that there are some Republican politicians, and I hate to be partisan, but this is partisan, you know, whether it's the governor of Texas or the governor of Mississippi, who just won't acknowledge the science that says we need to hold on a little bit longer, more masks, you know, everybody wear your mask, everybody stay a little distant, keep the restaurants open 25% or less, and let's get to the end of the finish line. But I think what we're going to see soon is that I'll give Trump credit for having developed the vaccines. What they did not do is find a way to get the vaccines into people's bodies. And so Biden has figured out how to do that, and it looks like we're going to get that done.
Matt, what do you think? Tomorrow we're going to hear the new president address the country. This is sure to come up. What will Republicans be looking to hear from Joe Biden?
Well, we'll see what his message is. You know, if Jamal's right, we should follow the science, which is why schools should be reopened all across the country. There have been no outbreaks in schools. Children under 18 are not getting coronavirus, and they're not transmitting it. And so the fact that the teachers' unions are holding our schools hostage is not only not following the science, but it's really kind of unconscionable. I think we want to see what the plan is from the president. Does he have a plan to reopen schools? Where are we at on vaccines? I know the Biden team wants to pretend like there was no national plan. PolitiFact has said that's not true. They said they wanted to be the first ones to get to 1 million vaccines a day. They got there under Trump. They pretended that the Johnson & Johnson Merck agreement was something they negotiated. They didn't. Trump negotiated that. Look, these are facts. These aren't opinions. Biden's team has now gone from about 1 million to 2 million a day. That's a very positive thing. And J&J is the game changer. J&J is the game changer. It's one dose. It doesn't have to be kept in the sub-zero temperatures that the other two vaccines have to be kept in. And they're able to produce at such a larger scale. And this, Jamal, is why the governor of Texas and the governor of Mississippi and a couple other states have felt the confidence to start reopening the economy. It's because not only have positivity rates gone down, ICU bed capacity gone up, and deaths gone down to really modern lows in the last year, but it's that the vaccines are ramping up because of Johnson & Johnson. So Operation Warp Speed is the single most significant American accomplishment in the last 25 years. We do need to get past this. People still need to be responsible. Wear a mask when you can't social distance. Try not to travel. Use good hygiene, all of those things. But we have learned what Jamal said, which is tremendous resilience among the American people, the frontline workers, the medical professionals, people in medical research. It's been extraordinary. And even people in government, particularly at the federal level, people like Dr. Anthony Fauci, who have committed such amazing work and expertise and discipline and devotion to our country. These are true heroes, and we should all be very grateful.
Look, one thing I want to get to before we go, and we got about a minute and a half for both of you to weigh in here. I want to take a look at what's happening in Nevada this week. Bernie Sanders-backed Democratic Socialists won control of the state party. They ousted a group of Democrats that were more aligned with former Senator Harry Reid. Jamal, you quickly first. What does that say to you? Does this have ramifications beyond the key state of Nevada?
Yeah, I have some experience here. I was a consultant to the Nevada Democratic Party for 2008, 2010 political cycles. And the Reid machine is a real thing. It delivered the state to Democrats in the 2008, 12, and 16 and 20 elections. And it also made sure that, you know, they won the state Senate back for some period of time and redistricted and a bunch of things. So the danger that people are worried about in the state is that they'll get more caught up in ideological fights than they will get caught up in trying to win elections. And so we'll see if that will happen and if other more liberal efforts try to take over state parties in other parts of the country.
Matt, I'm so sorry. I don't have time unless you can give me a two-word answer. And I know that's not fair.
Stay tuned.
Exactly. Matt Makoviak, our Republican strategist, and Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Neuroscientist Kimberly Noble wants to know, if a family gets more money,
does it directly impact children's cognitive development?
Ideas about the brain. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
We reported recently that people with Down syndrome are at high risk for serious illness or even death if they get COVID-19. Many are now among the early vaccine recipients, and we wanted to follow up by speaking with one of them. Callum Borschers of member station WBUR introduces us to a Massachusetts man who recently received his second dose after surviving a bout with the coronavirus earlier this year.
Jonathan Durr is 41. He lives on Cape Cod, works at a grocery store, and he's a big 90s wrestling fan.
Most of my favorites are John Cena, The Rock, Stone Cold.
That's John Cena, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and Stone Cold Steve Austin for the uninitiated. Durr had plenty of time to watch wrestling reruns when he was laid up with COVID-19 in January.
At first, I said, why me? Why I have COVID? It's like a cold, chills, fever, headaches.
Did you know when you got sick that having Down syndrome made you perhaps more susceptible to being ill, that it could be particularly dangerous to have COVID-19 because you have Down syndrome?
I heard about it because we have friends who have Down syndrome also, but just can't give up.
Durr didn't give up, even during a scary stretch that included a trip to Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. His mother, Joanne Simons, runs the Northeast chapter of ARC, a national advocacy group for people with developmental disabilities.
I was terrified when Jonathan's test came back positive. Sort of I went into this, really high alarm mode because it was becoming clear that adults with Down syndrome, especially men over 40, were at highest risk for morbidity and mortality from COVID.
Simons says people often think of Down syndrome as an intellectual disability without realizing that it's caused by an extra chromosome, which can also lead to other health complications.
And Jonathan, if you look at the list of CDC comorbidity factors, it has about six of them. He has a pulmonary valve that's been replaced. He has congenital heart disease. He has ventricular tachycardia. He has a defibrillator, all of which singularly are factors. In addition, he has some lung disease. So when he was, I learned that he was positive, I tried very hard and successfully not to read the studies because they were becoming well publicized the week of his diagnosis. And I have since read them. And of course, it would have made me even more nervous.
One of those studies in the UK suggested people with Down syndrome are 10 times more likely than the general population to die from COVID-19. Durr and his mother believe he may have recovered well because he exercised regularly before contracting the virus. He's now back to using a treadmill and elliptical.
Oh, and I forgot, I do Special Olympics.
And you do Special Olympics. Which events?
Basketball, track, golf in the summer, and soccer in the fall.
Durr says now that he's vaccinated, he hopes to be on the soccer field and back to other team sports soon. For Here and Now, I'm Callum Borchers.
California Governor Gavin Newsom is predicting brighter days ahead for the state, even as his own political future faces a mounting challenge from Californians who want to recall him from office. In his annual State of the State address, Newsom, a Democrat, defended his administration's pandemic response.
So to the California critics out there who are promoting partisan political power grabs with outdated prejudices and rejecting everything that makes California truly great, we say this. We will not be distracted from getting shots in arms and our economy booming again.
Nicole Nixon covers politics and government for Cat Public Radio, and she joins us now for more. Hey, Nicole.
Hey, Tanya.
So Newsom gave the address at Dodger Stadium here in Los Angeles, which is now a mass vaccination site. And he pointed out that the number of Californians who've died of the coronavirus so far is almost enough to fill that stadium, more than 54,000 people. And Newsom tried to cast himself as a leader on pandemic response. But he's also been under this pandemic-related scandal. So how did he defend his administration's coronavirus policies?
He spent almost this whole speech defending his management of the pandemic. He got quite a bit of praise at the beginning last year for this quick response, you know, early stay-at-home orders that did work to flatten the curve. He also talked about these early efforts to get more ventilators, which we ended up not really needing and sending out to New York and other states last spring. But Newsom has also taken a lot of heat for these onerous business restrictions and this sort of whiplash of opening and closing again. The other big thing is that Newsom was caught eating with a large group of people at this posh Napa Valley restaurant. You know, that was about 5 months ago at the same time he was telling people to avoid these kinds of gatherings, and he's still paying the price for that. So here's what he had to say about those mistakes.
You know, I know our progress hasn't always felt fast enough. And look, we've made mistakes. I have made mistakes, but we own them. We learn from them, and we never stop trying. After all, that's the California spirit.
Nicole, staying with the pandemic, Newsom said Californians should, quote, allow ourselves to dream of brighter days ahead. But what are you hearing from public health officials about the state of the pandemic in California right now? Are equity and distribution, which we've talked so much about, still plaguing the vaccine rollout here?
Yeah, well, California has ramped up its vaccination rollout, you know, like a lot of other states. But the reality is that there are some other issues here, too. You know, it has improved, but getting data about how many doses were going to which counties was hard to get. Just last week, Newsom announced that as we do get more doses, the state is going to set aside 40% of those vaccines for lower income communities, the ones that have been hit hardest by the virus. There are still a lot of questions now about how that is going to work. These communities are largely low income, you know, minority commuters, a lot of non-English speakers, less likely to have reliable internet to sign up for traditional vaccine appointments. So it will still be a challenge to make sure that people in these hard-hit communities will be able to actually get those vaccines.
Newsom has also come under fire for his decisions around businesses opening and closing. And last night, he did address some of the economic fallout. What did he say about that?
Well, he tried to, again, paint this very optimistic picture. He says that California won't just come crawling back, we'll come roaring back. What he did not mention is that the state's unemployment agency has been perhaps the biggest failure of this pandemic. Millions of people seeking unemployment overwhelmed the system very early on. There's been this persistent backlog. Still nearly a million people are waiting to get their unemployment benefits. But the state's made efforts to address some of these economic inequities we hear about. Newsom and state lawmakers just a week or two ago approved this Golden State stimulus that will send $600 stimulus checks to lower income families and undocumented Californians, which have been left out of federal stimulus packages.
I mean, Newsom did not talk about the recall in his speech last night or make say the word recall, but did he address the elephant in the room?
Yeah, he called it a partisan power grab being pushed by naysayers and doomsdayers. And he spent his entire speech just, you know, making the case that the light is at the end of the tunnel. We're emerging from this pandemic under his leadership and that he can lead the state through the rest of it.
That's Nicole Nixon, who covers politics and government for CAT Public Radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The U.S. Army is looking to give its helicopters a significant reboot. It launched an initiative over a decade ago asking aircraft manufacturers to create prototypes for next-generation helicopters with increased speed and range. Now, some of those choppers are close to liftoff. From IEEE Spectrum, Ari Daniel reports.
There's the Black Hawk, the Apache, and the Chinook, all Army helicopters that, over the last several decades, have gone through a series of upgrades. But performance improvements haven't changed their fundamental capabilities.
If you had an aircraft that could fly up to 150 knots, you won't be able to upgrade it to flying to 250 knots.
Farhan Gandhi is an aerospace engineer at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. The limitation is a physical one. Push a conventional copter through the air faster than 195 miles per hour or so, and the rotors, those spinning blades up top, struggle to provide enough lift.
So the Army started asking about what next. And of course, there is always the interest in more range, more speed, because that really translates to lives.
In 2009, the Army launched its Future Vertical Lift Initiative to encourage companies to prototype next-gen rotorcraft. More than a decade later, there are a couple future long-range assault aircraft contenders at the testing stage. First up is the Defiant X, created by Sikorsky and Boeing. Bill Fell is an experimental test pilot with Sikorsky.
There's two rotors on this aircraft, one on top of the other, that turn in opposite directions.
Each rotor gives lift on its advancing side. The rotorcraft, built using this coaxial design, allow rapid acceleration and deceleration and are quite maneuverable.
You get this crisp, fast response that doesn't feel like any other helicopter. Flying in and amongst the trees and the obstacles, and honestly, like, I love it.
Plus, it's speedy. Here's Fell aboard a test flight.
Roger, over 200, just the beginning here. This thing's got a lot more in it.
Then there's the team from Bell and Lockheed Martin working on the V-280 Valor. Think helicopter body with a wing across the top that's got a rotor attached to either side. On liftoff, those rotors spin just like a regular helicopter's. But then, once in flight, you tilt the rotors forward so they become propellers, with that wing providing the lift. Paul Wilson is a program manager at Bell.
So you get the benefits of being able to fly like a helicopter and then essentially transform the aircraft to fly forward like a turboprop aircraft very quietly, very efficiently, very smoothly. It's a good, comfortable ride.
The Marine Corps' Osprey aircraft, which is currently in use, also relies on a tilt rotor design. But both its rotors and engines rotate. With the Valor, it's just the rotors.
The reasons we did that, the troops get in and out the sides of the aircraft. We wanted to make sure that there wasn't an engine essentially in the way there and also putting hot engine exhaust in that area.
The Valor has reached sustained flight speeds above 345 miles per hour. The Defiant X, 243, still a bit shy of the 265 the Army's asking for. Rensselaer's Farhan Gandhi.
both of them will work very well.
So if you were on the selection committee, do you have a rotorcraft that you would select as being at the front of the pack?
I will absolutely take the Fifth Amendment on that.
But, says Gandhi, if you want to go really fast, upwards of 350 miles per hour, say,
the tilt rotor might be a superior choice.
But he says the Defiant X's coaxial approach tends to get you a better hovering efficiency.
That means that you are able to hover while consuming less power. But it depends on the mission, right?
For the Army, these missions will involve combat and war. And once they're used domestically, there will be humanitarian missions too, for medevac, search and rescue, disaster relief. But for these companies, the mission right now is to make these new rotorcraft fast, fast. For Here and Now, I'm Ari Daniel.
In that massive coronavirus relief package, there is much needed money for transportation. Airports and Amtrak will get an infusion of cash, and about $30 billion will go to transit agencies, many staring down huge deficits 1 year now into the pandemic. Here and Now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Peter.
And why don't we start with public transit, trains, buses, subways. Where's all the money going?
Well, you said it, trains, buses, subways, but more specifically, of that $30 billion, about $26 billion to those urban transportation systems. So we're talking about $6 billion for New York subway, for example, $1.5 billion for the metro system in Washington, rail there as well as buses, smaller amounts for rural systems. But yeah, this is definitely a bill that, you know, now that you have Democrats in charge of the House, the Senate, and the White House, able to direct some of those resources to places where the public transportation advocates wanted it in the first place.
Well, and it's needed. The American Public Transportation Association estimates that the industry is going to face an almost $40 billion budget shortfall through 2023. So is all that money enough to solve their problems?
Well, I mean, the simple math tells you, we said $30 billion being infused and, as you said, $40 billion shortfall. So this doesn't completely close the gap. These are largely fixed cost systems. And a fixed cost business is one where even when it does a lot less business, the costs kind of continue anyway, right? It costs almost as much to run a subway, whether or not there's anybody on board. But of course, when there's nobody on board, you're not getting the revenue from those people. They're not buying tickets. And so, so that's the issue here. A lot of this is going to depend, Peter, on just sort of the trajectory of, you know, how quickly ridership recovers, because if not, you have systems again with a lot of those costs baked in, even though they aren't getting the revenue, but they won't fill all the gaps, but they got a lot of what they wanted this time more than they did in the first stimulus bills.
Yeah. Another struggling agency or company, Amtrak, had to furlough more than 1,200 workers and cut some of its routes as well. But it's going to get nearly $2 billion as a part of the package. Do you think that will be enough to hire back the workers that lost their jobs and get those routes back into service?
Yeah. So Amtrak, another entity that has gotten more of what it wanted. In fact, it ended up getting a couple hundred million more than it thought in the first place. And yeah, this is a situation where Amtrak now is going to sort of have some – well, you might almost say more strings attached to aid, where it's getting all this money. But part of the idea is that those furloughed workers would be able to come back on as it restores, for example, some of the long haul service routes that were down to just 3 days a week, be able to bring them back up to daily service throughout the country. About half the aid will go to the Northeast Corridor, those busy routes between places like Boston, New York, and Washington, and with the other half spread around the country.
And how about air travel, Seth? Because for the third time now, airlines are going to get help paying their employees to avoid furloughs. What else is in store for them here?
Right. So about $15 billion now extended for basically another half year, where airlines are getting all of this money, but the string attached there is that they have to keep a lot of people employed. It means the airlines are probably a little bit bigger than they would be if they weren't getting that money, right? If they were only responding to sort of that much lower level of demand for air travel that exists right now, but able to keep those people on the payrolls. Airports as well, Peter. $8 billion in their case. And with them, it's kind of like what I said about those public transportation systems. You know, you build a big airport and the costs are all baked in And then when the airlines aren't flying there, the airports aren't collecting the same fees and taxes that they usually would. So airports really, in some ways, with even less flexibility than airlines to reduce their costs. And so they're glad to be getting that amount of funding.
Seth, for the past year, you've been coming on the show talking about how tough it has been for airlines. They really, really want to get more people in the air, especially as vaccinations pick up. And, you know, we saw this week the CDC still telling Americans to avoid non-essential travel, even if they've been fully vaccinated. So just wonder how the airlines are responding to that from the CDC.
They continue walking this delicate line that they've been walking, as you said, Peter, for about a year, right? Where up until a year ago, for most of the history of aviation, airlines have encouraged people to travel. But then that became unseemly, and they've sort of had this mixed messaging of, hey, it's up to you whether or not to travel, but when you do, we'll make it as safe as possible. And that basically here is continuing. One thing airlines are saying is that if there's some sort of a vaccine passport, let's say, which some advocates have been calling for, they just want it to be something standardized, universal, something national, led by the U.S. national government if it's going to be global, rather than states kind of doing their own thing. They see that as something that would be disruptive as they look forward to hopefully people being able to finally follow, hey, who knows, new CDC guidelines saying that you can begin traveling again more safely.
We'll see. We're all hoping for that. Here at Now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.